to do that in a way that will be accessible to people who are not chemists, or maybe it's been a long time since you sat in a chemistry class. We'll be talking specifically about one element, and that is plutonium. And our guest will be Jeremy Bernstein. He is a physicist. He's professor emeritus at the Stevens Institute of Technology. Also, he spent 35 years as a staff writer for The New Yorker. And we'll be talking about a book that has recently been published that he has authored that is titled Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. We'll talk a little bit about what it is, about how it is made, and about why it is that the stockpile of plutonium that we have now in the world is a problem. So that'll be hour number one. Hour two, our guest is Dennis Barron. He's a professor of English at University of Illinois. He'll be stopping by for another conversation about language. That will be in hour number two. So we hope that for this morning, on Focus 580, you'll hang around. And if you have questions or comments, you can give us a call.
WILL programming is made possible in part by the U of I College of Law, offering students the resources of a major research university, a world-renowned faculty, and opportunities for active learning both in the classroom and beyond. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by the 5th Annual Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, presenting La Traviata, the epitome of 19th century Italian opera, August 3rd through 5th in Watseka, Illinois. La Traviata features Mark Thompson as Alfredo and is conducted by the Metropolitan Opera's John Keenan. More information is available at sugarcreekfestival.org.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. When plutonium was first manufactured at Berkeley in 1941, there was so little of it that it wasn't visible to the naked eye. Now, however, there is so much plutonium produced that we don't know how to get rid of it. Today in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the history of this complex and dangerous element as we talk with physicist Jeremy Bernstein. He's the author of the book Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. It's been out for a little while. It's published earlier this spring. And we'll talk a little bit about how plutonium was changed from a laboratory novelty into, effectively, the most destructive weapon, one of the most destructive weapons the world has ever known. And, of course, questions, comments from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest is a Harvard-educated physicist and professional writer. He is professor emeritus of physics at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. Also, he was, for 35 years, a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is the author of a number of popular science books. He's also well-known for profiles of both scientists and other notable people, including Albert Einstein and Stanley Kubrick. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. All we ask of people is that they're trying to be brief and keep their questions short, so that way we can get in as many different people as possible. But certainly comments from people who are listening are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. Professor Bernstein, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Right.
We appreciate it.
My father used to say about Harvard men,
yes,
that you can always tell a Harvard man, but not much.
Well, we'll just let that go.
Right.
Let me start, I guess. And this is really, my last time I spent any time thinking about these sorts of things was a long time ago, and was not always all that swift when it came to science. So I'm struggling a little bit here, and perhaps also people who are listening are too. But at the end, I expect that they will know a little bit more than they started, or at least will remind them of what they once learned about.
And I'll know a little less.
Perhaps so. Well, your loss of knowledge is our gain. How about that? People will recall, probably thinking back to the last time that they were in a science classroom, the periodic table of
right.
elements. And they're arranged in blocks, and there are rows that go up and down and rows that go cross, vertical and horizontal.
Correct.
And it is called periodic because the horizontal lines are called periods.
Right. After a certain number of elements, then the table repeats in the sense that the next element has sensibly the same chemical properties as the one above it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there are a series of so-called perfect gases, oxygen and various gases are perfect gases and so on.
So before World War II, they're on the periodic table.
Actually, oxygen is not a perfect gas, but it's early in the morning out here. Argon is good. Neon.
Neon, helium.
Helium is good. Oxygen
xenon,
is not a good example,
right? Those are the noble gases. Before World War II, there were known to be 92 elements. The first one, that's hydrogen. The last one is uranium.
Correct.
Number 92. And so that was, uranium was that in that period, they're called actinides, that horizontal row.
Right.
There
was actinium.
It ended, beginning with actinium, and that's 89. It ended with uranium, 92. There was nothing else all the way across there.
Right. But people were quite sure there would be. Mm-hmm. And Fermi, for example, was awarded the Nobel Prize for allegedly discovering one of them, and it turned out that what he had discovered was not one of them. Actually, what he had discovered was fission, but they didn't know it at the time. So the first one of these actinides that was found was neptunium, and that was found by McMillan and Abelson. That preceded the work of Seaborg when they discovered plutonium. Neptunium is element 93, and they named it neptunium because it was the next planet out from Uranus, or however you pronounce it these days. And but they didn't call it that. That name was not revealed until after the war for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And then, so I'm assuming that then plutonium was named for Pluto.
It was named for Pluto, and that was also concealed until after the war. In fact, the discovery of Seaborg in 1941 was not revealed until 1945 in the Smyth Report, because it was understood immediately that plutonium was a fissile element. There's an important distinction between fissionable elements and fissile elements. A fissionable element or a fissionable nucleus is one that can be split if you hit it hard enough with a neutron, and a fissile element is one that can be split if you hit it with a neutron of any energy. And to make a nuclear weapon, you need a fissile element. For example, uranium-235 is a fissile nucleus, fissile isotope. Uranium-238 is not. And what Seaborg had discovered was plutonium-239, and he knew immediately that this would be a fissile element and therefore capable of being used as a nuclear explosive.
Hmm. The elements from 93 up, we now have 109, right?
Some large number.
Okay. From 93 up, essentially, do these things exist in nature at all?
Not really, or only at most in trace amounts. Mm-hmm. Plutonium exists, it's claimed. Some of the anisotope at least exists in some tiny trace amount. Some of the ones after plutonium were discovered in the detritus of nuclear tests, is where they were first discovered.
So these, they don't, as far as we know, they don't exist in nature. That the only way you can come up with them is to manufacture them essentially with a nuclear explosion, or you can also make them in a particle accelerator.
You can make them in a reactor.
Yeah,
and one of the things that is in discharge reactor fuel is neptunium and americium. So that's another nuisance that you have in these reactor fuels that have been used.
Well, maybe it would be worth talking, just asking you to talk just for a little bit about uranium, which was for long, this, as far as we know, it's the one at the end of the line of naturally occurring elements.
Right, 92. And in fact, there's uranium is not especially rare. It's found in pretty large quantities all over the earth. The uranium that comes out of a mine is the isotope 238 predominantly. 235 is less than a percent of that isotope, And 235 is the one that's fissile. So in order to use it for a weapon, you have to enrich the uranium that comes out of a mine from less than 1% uranium-235 to over 90% over 90% uranium-235. And that's a very complicated process, this enrichment, fortunately, because otherwise we'd have nuclear weapons in Guatemala and everywhere else. Mm-hmm.
So just uranium as it comes out of the ground, uranium-238, is not something that you can use to make a bomb?
No, you cannot. You cannot make explosive chain reaction with uranium-238. So what you have to do is you have to increase the percentage of uranium-235 in the sample from less than 1% to close to 90%. And there are various ways of doing this. The complication is that 235 and 238 have sensibly the same chemistry. So chemical processes are extremely difficult to do. So people separate them by physical processes such as centrifuges or electromagnetic separation or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to get me clear on this, you said that there's this difference between something that's fissionable and fissile.
Right.
And 238 fissionable?
It is fissionable.
It is. And yeah. And is that also, can you use 238 in a nuclear reactor, one that you would use to produce energy?
Yeah, you can. You can use it in a nuclear reactor, and in some nuclear reactors, one uses natural uranium. For example, in the Canadian reactors, the so-called CANDU reactors, you use natural uranium, which is unenriched. But in the reactor that the French built for the Iraqis, the one that was blown up by the Israelis, for some reason, the uranium that was used in that reactor was weapons grade. That was 93% enriched. So even after the Israelis bombed that reactor, there was a lot of fissile material left around. That what was left around could have been made into a crude nuclear weapon without really doing much of anything else.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Jeremy Bernstein. He's a physicist. He is professor emeritus of physics at Stevens Institute of Technology. That's in New Jersey, in Hoboken, New Jersey. He also was a staff writer for The New Yorker for 35 years. He has written a number of popular science books. His most recent is Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to go back and have you explain here, because I'm sure that people aren't quite sure about all these numbers. We talked about the fact that that uranium was the highest naturally occurring element, highest if you think about its atomic number, 92.
Yeah, it's 92 in the periodic table.
So it's 92. That means it has 92 electrons.
Right, 90. The nucleus, excuse me, has 92 protons.
92 protons.
And the rest are neutrons.
All right. And the number, that's why hydrogen, its number is 1. It has
right.
one electron. Helium, its number is 2. It has 2. So that's how you go up there.
Right.
So you got all the way up to 92, and that's uranium.
Right. And then each element has a number of isotopes. The isotopes have nuclei which have the same number of protons with a different number of neutrons. And a very important example is hydrogen. Ordinary hydrogen has 1 proton in the nucleus, and then heavy hydrogen has 1 proton, 1 neutron, and then tritium has 2 neutrons and 1 proton. And those three elements have very similar chemical properties, but very different physical properties. For example, tritium is unstable, deuterium is stable, and in so-called hydrogen bombs, you have fusions of these isotopes of hydrogen, in particular deuterium and tritium, fuse to make helium and a neutron.
So that's how many neutrons does a basic uranium atom have?
Well, what you have to do is you have to pick the isotope. Your arithmetic is probably better than mine. I'm not known for my strength in arithmetic, But what you have to do is you have to take you take the number 238, for example, then 92 protons. You take 238 minus 92, and that's the number of neutrons.
Oh, okay. Well, there, I guess what I'm getting at is you talked about the fact that there are these different isotopes.
Correct.
Of uranium.
Correct.
And the difference is that it's the same. Any of these have the same number of protons. It's
right.
Always
and therefore
92.
Therefore, the same number of electrons.
Same
and therefore,
number of electrons.
Sensibly, the same chemistry.
All right, but they do have different numbers of neutrons. So we have 238, 235, 234.
Right.
What? Why does that happen? Does that happen naturally? And then can you take 238 and do something to that to get it to a isotope that's fissile?
Yeah, I mean, you start with 238 and you convert it into plutonium in a reactor in a couple of steps. You first have the 238 absorb a neutron, then that becomes 239, and the 239 decays in various ways and ends up as plutonium-239. So, yeah, you can transform things in that way. Yeah, that's how you make plutonium.
Mm-hmm. Why? I guess I'm just going back to we talked earlier about the fact that, again, at one point, the periodic table stopped with uranium, stopped at 92, but
right.
that physicists and scientists had reason to believe that there were other elements out there, or that at least that, you know, that row
right.
should be some way to fill that out. And
well, at the time, yeah. Prior to the war, it wasn't known that it was a row. And people knew that there were heavy elements out there, but they had a rather incorrect idea of how they would fit into the periodic table. It was only during the war that it was discovered that there was this actinide series that you mentioned, all of which have similar properties in one way or another. Although plutonium is the most complicated by a long way.
Well, how was it that we just made the one step from uranium to neptunium, from 92 to 93? How was neptunium discovered?
Well, what happened is that there was a development in Berkeley of the cyclotron, thanks to William Lawrence. And the cyclotron provided sources, a neutron source. And McMillan and Abelson had available to them a rather large cyclotron, which they used as a source of neutrons. Abelson, who was only there actually for his vacation, he was on vacation and he'd been in the East, came back for his vacation, and they used his vacation to discover an element. And then McMillan went and worked on radar, so the field was left open to Glenn Seaborg. And then Glenn Seaborg used, again, a cyclotron to make plutonium.
So in this, essentially what they did was they took some uranium and bombarded that with neutrons, and
right.
then the uranium grabbed these extra neutrons, and then from that you get higher isotopes of uranium that then decay into these other elements?
That's exactly
elements?
What happens, right. And then Seaborg used the reactor to produce a beam of deuterons, so he was actually able to get even different isotopes.
When these experiments were done, was this at that point? Are we just talking about pure science there? We were just doing it for the sake of enlarging the knowledge base of the universe.
Yes, certainly, McMillan Abelson had no notion of neptunium being useful for a nuclear explosion at all. And in fact, the isotope of neptunium that they produced is not useful for a nuclear weapon because it decays too quickly. By the time that Seaborg got into the act, February of 1941, he realized immediately that the isotope of plutonium that he produced was fissile, and therefore everything had to be immediately classified. Mm-hmm. And so, as I said, nothing was revealed about plutonium until the Smyth report in August of 1945.
Now, before that, though, had it been proposed that it would be possible to take uranium and process that in a way so that you would have something that was fissile and that could make a bomb?
Well, it depends what era you're talking about. Prior to the discovery of fission, which was in the end of 1938, this issue did not arise, except in the mind of Leo Szilard, who envisioned in the early 1930s the idea of a chain reaction. He just thought of this out of his head. He had no idea of fission either, but he imagined that there might be some reaction which you could produce neutrons, and these neutrons could in turn initiate new reactions, and you would have a chain. And he was so unnerved by this that he actually took out a secret patent with the British Navy. And then when fission was discovered at the end of 1938, the immediate question was whether there would be extra neutrons. And pretty soon after fission was discovered, Fermi in the United States and Szilard himself, and then Joliot in France found the neutrons. And immediately that they found the neutrons, they realized that a chain reaction was possible. And so the whole atomic bomb business was off and running.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jeremy Bernstein. Just want to mention again, he is a physicist. He is emeritus professor of physics at Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey, Hoboken, New Jersey. He also was a staff writer for The New Yorker for 35 years. He's held appointments at the Institute for Advanced Study, at Brookhaven National Lab, at CERN, at Oxford, at University of Islamabad and École Polytechnique and Los Alamos. He's written many popular science books and is author of a new book just out. It's been out now, I think, a couple of months. I believe it came out in April. Is that right?
I've often wondered if any of my students at Islamabad actually worked on the Pakistani bomb. I'm curious about that.
So, you don't know about that, huh?
No, I don't. I mean, what I was teaching was elementary particle physics. Certainly would not have been very useful for making a bomb. And but there was a reactor at that time in Pakistan. They were very proud of it. I went to see it. They were not thinking of going nuclear when I was there, which was 1969. But as soon as the Indians exploded a weapon, then the Pakistanis decided that they must have a weapon immediately, and they pulled out all the stops.
Well, our guest is the author of the recent book, Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element, published by Joseph Henry Press. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you this. Going back to the point where plutonium was first discovered.
Right.
At that point, how much right there at the very beginning, how much plutonium was there in the world?
Well, the only plutonium in the world was what, apart from these trace amounts of some long-lived isotope, which people either think they have or have not discovered, but they're just simply traces. In the beginning, there were only micrograms. Hmm. And really until the 1940s, 1943-44, most of the work that was done on plutonium was done with micrograms, was microchemistry and so on.
So if you were going to make one nuclear bomb,
right?
Let us say something similar to the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, which was a plutonium bomb.
Right.
The other one was a uranium bomb, the first one.
Correct.
How much plutonium, say you're going to just make one bomb, how much plutonium do you need?
Well, it depends how clever you are. In the weapons business, there is something called a bear crit. A bear crit is a sphere of plutonium with no bells and whistles. That is, You don't do anything to improve the efficiency of the weapon. And the critical mass of a bear crit of plutonium-239 is about 10 kilograms. But if you're clever and do stuff, you can get it down to about 6 kilograms.
Hmm. And the plutonium that was used in that first bomb, was that produced at Hanford in Washington?
It was. It was produced at Hanford, and that was known as super weapons grade plutonium. The difference between weapons grade and non-weapons grade plutonium is the amount of unwanted isotopes that are in the plutonium. Plutonium has many isotopes, and the wanted one for bomb work is 239. But inevitably, in reactor, you also produce plutonium-240, which is undesirable. And so weapons-grade plutonium is plutonium which has, at best, only a very small percentage of 240. And the kind of weapons-grade plutonium that was used in the bomb was super weapons-grade because it had very little 240. And the reason for that was that they pulled it out of the reactor so fast that it did not have a time to absorb a second neutron. The way you make these other isotopes is you let the thing sit in the reactor, and then first the uranium absorbs one neutron, then you make an isotope of plutonium, but there's so many neutrons around that if you let it sit there, then the plutonium absorbs a neutron and becomes another isotope of plutonium. And plutonium-240 is an undesirable isotope.
Hmm. So this was produced in a reactor at Hanford in Washington State, where nuclear fuel, that is material for nuclear weapons, was produced for a long time.
Right.
How long?
Still trying to clean it up.
And that, as you say, it's an enormous problem. One of a number of places around the country that were Department of Defense sites that are extremely polluted, loaded with all kinds of bad stuff.
Right.
How long did it take? How long did they have to run the reactor to get enough plutonium, that much plutonium for one weapon?
Well, I forget exactly how long they had to run the reactor, but it took until 1944 or so before they had even a gram of plutonium at Los Alamos. And it took until 1945 before they had enough to make one bomb. Oppenheimer used to say that that the materials arrived at Los Alamos at just about the same time that the theory was perfected. So it really was not until 1945 when enough plutonium arrived at Los Alamos, namely the 10 kilograms or so needed to make a weapon. Mm-hmm.
So when they first started producing the plutonium, they weren't completely sure how exactly they were going to construct this device.
No, they were sure about how they're going to construct the reactors, but you have tons and tons of uranium fuel in a given reactor, and of those tons, maybe only a pound or a fraction of a pound of plutonium is produced. In other words, you don't produce in a reactor loads and loads of plutonium. You produce a very small amount per ton of uranium that's fissioned. So it takes a long time if you want to produce kilogram quantities.
And how then do you get the plutonium? Is the plutonium, everything sort of all mixed in there together? How do you separate out the plutonium?
Yes, that's a pretty complicated chemistry. Working with plutonium is not easy, and that requires a very complicated chemistry, which was worked out.
And of course, it's an extraordinarily hazardous material, so great care has to be taken in its handling. Obviously,
yes, great care has to be taken in its handling. The plutonium-239 is an alpha particle emitter. That is to say, it emits nuclei of helium. It doesn't penetrate the skin readily, but if you swallow it, then it will latch on to some organs, and because of the radioactivity, very small amounts can do you in. We saw an example with this murder of this agent in London, Liftonenko, I think he's called, mm-hmm. with polonium-210, that's a similar alpha particle-emitting isotope, a little more active than plutonium. But the danger with this is ingesting it, not because it's so toxic, but because of the radioactivity.
Well, I now have a number of callers who'd like to come into the conversation, so let's do that. We'll take them in the order that they came, starting with Belgium. That is the community not far from here, and that's line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Your guest just mentioned the topic I was going to bring up, in that your opening words was the most dangerous of elements, and polonium seems to be far more dangerous in that it's almost impossible to keep inside of a container. It likes to wander around very well, which at least plutonium kind of likes to stay in one place. And that's why the poisoning was so bad and found so far throughout Europe, because every place the guy stopped, a little bit got out.
Right. Well, I myself didn't like the subtitle, The World's Most Dangerous Element, to be quite honest with you, because I don't know what that means. But I accepted it because there are several dangers involved. First of all, as the caller points out, it's dangerous if you swallow it because of the radioactivity. But also, it's dangerous because you can make a nuclear weapon out of it. You cannot make a nuclear weapon out of polonium. So, in that sense, polonium is, in that larger sense, I would say, somewhat less dangerous.
It's, even though it is very, 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 very poisonous.
Well, it has the same issues as plutonium or any alpha particle emitter. Namely, if you ingest a radioactive element, if you eat it, then it will go to some organ, like anything you eat. And now you have inside you, in some organ, something which is emitting alpha particles, and that is going to produce very deleterious results, cancers and all, and God knows what. And you saw what it did to that poor Russian guy. And only very, very small amounts eaten or smoked will have those effects. So I don't know how much this guy ingested or smoked, but it was probably fractions of a gram. It may not even have been anything that might have been a speck that he wouldn't have even noticed.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. The polonium story is interesting in that it's also very difficult to smuggle because it does have this tendency to wander, and it's kind of unexamined that the guy actually might have been a smuggler, and then they decided to use the story. But that's a digression. You were just talking about what was going to be my second point, so why don't I do that first, which is this idea that the models that are used for radiation damage are not the ones that include ingestion that much, and particularly aerosol ingestion, and that it's much more dangerous, and that 238, even though it has a very long half-life, is actually dangerous if it lodges somewhere and super a particle, and has a tendency to break down into small particles, and it has a tendency to loft for some reason too that other chemicals or other radioactive materials don't seem to. It goes down to 10 microns fairly easily, and that's a very dangerous size apparently. I'm citing the work of Chris Busby, B-U-S-B-Y, a British theorist who's on the Royal Society's committee to examine low-level radiation in Europe, and that's at Trap Rock Peace Center. But you were talking about how there was nothing above 92, and I seem to remember this story about the mountains of the moon in Gabon, and I found a Department of Energy.gov website, which may not be entirely reliable, but they argue that there was this area in Gabon where there was such a density of uranium that it actually became a natural reactor, and that what was moderating it was the water that would seep in and then boil out, so it wouldn't explode because but that is a there's possible.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and that must have had trace amounts of plutonium in it. I don't know whether anybody saw that's certainly not how it was detected. that's not how it was discovered, but it certainly must have had trace amounts of plutonium. But you're absolutely right. There was a natural reactor there. I don't know whether there are any others anywhere. I mean, to have a natural reactor, you would have to have a very major deposit of uranium. Now, earlier, the isotopic composition of uranium would have been very different. I mean, if you go back far enough in time, then there probably would have been nearly as much 235 as 238, since the only reason there's a difference is a difference in half-lives. And so you would have had a situation which you would have enriched uranium. And as you say, the water would have been a moderator. So in order for there to be another such place, you'd have to have, first of all, a uranium deposit and then water. I don't know if anybody's ever discovered another such place, but that certainly is an amazing example.
Yeah, what you're saying is there's a natural decay. If there's a difference in the ratio that can't be explained by the relative natural decay, then this might be a place where there eons ago there may have been a natural reactor of some sort.
That's right.
And the plutonium has also got a long half-life, so there should be some of this. So the idea that there were no transuranics natural. I was wondering whether in the construction of atoms in stars, about the iron cycle and the carbon cycle and that they're in somewhere in the universe, maybe there is some calculations on this, rule out that in a certain kind of star, a neutron star, that transuranics could be constructed.
Oh, but, yeah. I mean, you know, all these heavy elements came from the stars. They all came from supernova explosion in the first instance. And when they landed in the solar system, the isotopic composition must have been totally different. I mean, they were probably all these rare isotopes were equally abundant, more or less, at that time. And then because of the different half-lives, you have now only the ones with the long half-lives. But I don't know if with this natural reactor, whether anybody has found trace amounts of plutonium. It's a very interesting question, the answer to which I do not know.
Well, it may have also, then you'd have to see that the neutrons in this natural process might have been fast enough to decay some of the, or fission some of those, too. So then you might have to, it gets all very, very complicated, which is another point I think I wanted to raise, is that fissile and fissional are different in the sense that the latter, fissionable, doesn't produce a neutron at the right rate of speed to sustain a chain reaction. Isn't that correct? It's either, I can't remember if it's too fast or too slow. In the moderating, what the water does is slow down, if I recall, the neutrons.
Yeah, well, that's part of the issue. With a fissionable nucleus, you need a certain threshold, as I mentioned. Now, what happens is that in the fission of uranium-235, or rather 238, the neutrons that come out, at least some of them, are energetic enough to produce the next fission, but too many of them get slowed down, and therefore the effective number of neutrons available for the next fission is too small to produce a chain reaction. But when the neutrons that come out have a spectrum of energies. They have a distribution of energies. And some neutrons in that spectrum are energetic enough to cause the next uranium-238 to fission. But not enough of them. They bounce off stuff, and then they get slowed down. So they start off with enough energy. So they bounce around before they make the next fission, and then they get slowed down. And then, effectively, there are not enough of them to make the next fission. So you don't make a chain reaction that way. But it's close. It's fairly close.
Again, I'm remembering things from too long ago, but it's kind of a balance between the being too fast to be gone too quick to be useful, if I can use that rather bizarre term, to continue the chain reaction. But then, so the moderation that happens in a regular reactor. Well, anyway, I wanted to just emphasize a point that I brought up that didn't treat, which is the idea, and this is far afield from the subject matter of simply a polonium, but plutonium. But the idea that this lodging, even there, this Busby fellow has done calculations to show the strontium from the atmospheric nuclear test is still having an effect on cancer development around the world. So
I'm sure that's true. I myself witnessed two above-ground nuclear explosions in 1957, and that test series, which is Plumbob, which I saw too, put enough radioactive iodine in the air to cause its estimated 38,000 cases of thyroid cancer. And I'm not the slightest bit surprised that there's still fallout effects on people.
I'm going to jump in here because we have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, and I want to introduce again our guest, Jeremy Bernstein. He is Professor Emeritus of Physics at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. He was a staff writer for The New Yorker for 35 years, has written a number of popular science books, is the author of a recent book entitled Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. Just to go back, we were talking a little bit about how little plutonium there was, as far as anybody knew, in 1941 when it was discovered, and then it first was started to be manufactured on a large scale to make for the Manhattan Project to make the first nuclear weapons, and then after that, much more was made to develop the U.S. nuclear arsenal. How much plutonium is there in the world today?
Oh God, hundreds of tons, hundreds of tons. It's estimated that about 70 tons a year are produced by the civilian reactors, the power reactors. And then there's tons and tons of stuff left over in the military reactors. I mean, we have thousands of nuclear pits, which we're just storing in different places. And that must represent tons. So there's tons and tons of the stuff.
And the problem is, obviously, as we've discussed, it is radioactive, it is highly toxic, and it is very long-lived. And that means that it is the large amount of this stuff is a serious problem, not only because it's hazardous in and of itself, but also it's the material from which you could make a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, and it's very hard to get rid of. I mean, you think of different methods of trying to get rid of it. And they all have problems. I mean, the first thing that might come to mind is that why not use this stuff in reactors and just make plutonium reactors and get rid of it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that making a plutonium reactor is substantially more dangerous and complicated than a uranium reactor. So it's not easy to use it in that way. And also, you would, again, produce stuff that you would have to get rid of if you did that. So it's kind of diabolical. It doesn't seem to want to be gotten rid of.
Hmm. So then it seems that the idea would be that we would have to have safe, secure storage for the plutonium for a very long time.
Right.
And this gets into these difficult proliferation issues. That is, there are people who perhaps would like to build nuclear weapons, and it's much easier if you can get the plutonium all ready to go rather than make your own. How is it being stored now? And I suppose some of it is already exists in a weapons form, and other it's in the what you call the pits, which are the sort of the seed, the thing that you need to make the weapon.
It's a central sphere that's plutonium that's imploded to make the nuclear weapon go. Well, the pits are being stored in various places, in some place in Texas and one place in another, and they're simply stored as pits. They're presumably sitting on shelves. The atmosphere you have to be very careful with the storage because plutonium has an extremely unpleasant property of spontaneously bursting into fire if it reacts with water vapor. So you have to be very careful about when you store them that you don't have water vapor floating around. And also, there's the radioactivity, so they're kind of decaying from the inside and from the outside, and there's a difference of opinion as to their durability. Some estimates say that they're good for half a century. Other people say for a century. Other people say that that less. So there's a certain amount of controversy about that. Now, as far as the plutonium from reactors are concerned, that just is part of the spent fuel elements, which in the United States at least are taken out of the reactors and stored in swimming pools. Mm-hmm. Every reactor has its swimming pool, and these things are dumped into the pool, and they sit there, which is rather crazy. The French, who have about 78% of their electricity is provided by nuclear power, they vitrify the waste products. They put them into glass logs, and then they bury them somewhere. So that's what they do. That seems to me to be the most sensible thing to do. But then you have to find a place to bury them. And every time a place is proposed, there are objections by people. For example, Yucca Mountain is in Nevada, and Harry Reid said that over his dead body, will anything be buried there? So until people come to the conclusion it's better to bury them someplace than leave them in swimming pools, that's what the situation that they're in.
Yeah, Yucca Mountain, that's a site that has been developed by the Department of Energy, and it was supposed to start accepting waste a long, long time ago, and now I guess there's some question about whether, in fact, it ever will.
Well, if Harry Reid has his way, it'll never accept any waste. And I think people are too demanding. You know, you want something to be assured for 500 years or 1,000 years or 10,000 years. That's just too much to ask. I mean, you have a present menace, and I just don't think that you can be that futuristic if you have to deal with the present menace. I don't think so, but not everybody agrees with me.
Let's see if we get one more call here. Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry I missed most of all of this conversation, but I do have two questions. Mm-hmm. Are they still finding traces of plutonium? Are they monitoring for the plutonium outside of Boulder, Colorado at Rocky Flats, which was operated for the U.S. government by Rockwell International in the 60s and 70s and 80s?
Right.
And there's plenty of biological graphic evidence when they had accidental releases of plutonium into the environment there, and they managed to surround the facility with subdivisions. Are they still monitoring for traces of plutonium there?
That's a very interesting question about Rocky Flats. I'm in Aspen now, and I'm, maybe 130 miles from Rocky Flats.
Uh-huh.
Now, the claim is the following. They claim that the site is now completely remediated.
Well, they've destroyed, they've moved, they've eliminated virtually every building on the site and have carted everything away and probably buried it somewhere else. The second question I had, and I want to hear you finish your first answering. My first question is: Are they manufacturing plutonium anywhere else in the United States today?
Not only as byproducts of civilian reactors. There's no military plutonium creation project in the United States.
That's great.
I don't know if it's great, but
at least we're not adding to the stockpile that we already have.
Except for the civilian reactors, yeah. Which is an inevitable product of the civilian reactors, and
right.
Worldwide, they produce 70 tons a year, and we do our share.
If you want to go back, I apologize for interrupting what you know about the Rocky Flats site, but please go ahead.
I tell you what you might be interested in reading, if you have access to a library. We have a trade journal called Physics Today, and Physics Today has semi-popular articles. It's kind of addressed to physicists and their friends and so on. About 6 months ago, three Los Alamos scientists wrote a very, very interesting article about the science of plutonium disposition at Rocky Flats. And this was the first time that real scientists had got into the act. And what they discovered basically is that the plutonium there was not soluble in water. So that simplified the remediation. It became a topsoil removal issue. Now, they claim, and I've contacted them, they claim that all the topsoil has been removed. And I read in the paper only a few days ago that the claim now is that the site is completely remediated, and they're kind of turning it into a park. So that's the claim. I haven't been there myself, but that's what's being claimed.
Mm. We're at the point we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. Just one more time, if you'd like to read in greater detail, brush up on your chemistry, and learn more about plutonium, you can look for this book that we mentioned. It's titled Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element, by our guest Jeremy Bernstein. He is Professor Emeritus of Physics at Stevens Institute of Technology. He's also a former staff writer for The New Yorker. And Professor Bernstein, thanks very much.
You're more than welcome.
Programs here on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2007-2008 season brochure and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the 2007-2008 season of guest artists are now available. Coming up a little later today on the Afternoon Magazine, the monthly program that they call Computers and You, the guest this month will be science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. So if you're thinking about buying a new computer and you're kind of confused about the options, or maybe you're having a problem with the machine that you have and just can't get it to do what you want, you can call in and talk with Greg, and I know he will do his best to help you out. Coming up in the next part of this show, we welcome back Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. Everyone's in a while he's here. We talk about language, how sometimes the language is abused. Complaints are welcome. Also questions about grammar, any and all of that coming up in the next part of Focus 580. So we hope that you will stay with us. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. We'll break for news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Bastifer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Corn is locked limit down from the September 2007 contract all the way out to July of 2008. And then in September and December of 2008, down almost the limit on weather. And it's all about weather and nothing about weather today. The weather that was in the forecast on Friday, calling for ridging activity and hot and dry conditions in the eastern Corn Belt, gave way to more friendly growing conditions in the overnight.